It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
Thanks, Claude. Hey, welcome back to Chatter on Books, everybody. I don't know where you are, but it's a spectacular day here in the DMV. So hope in this time of pandemic you're enjoying some good weather. Glad you're with us. And in just a little bit, I'll be getting my Steel Town girl on because we'll be talking with Jim Rooney, who is from Pittsburgh Steelers Royalty, and he has a wonderful book called A Different Way to Win, Dan Rooney's Story from the Super Bowl to the Rooney Rule. And Dan Rooney, as I was just saying to David and Liz, we know an exceptional person in terms of his leadership of the Steelers and his leadership in the NFL and the Rooney Rule, which we'll talk about. He was a truly exceptional ambassador to Ireland. I don't think his career got enough of that attention. And we got a few other things on tap. We got to talk about RBG a little bit if we have time to talk about what's going on in the world of sports. But most importantly, we have Claude doing everything important. We have David with us, thankfully. And joining us, the inimitable Liz Clark, who spells her last name the same as mine. And I would trade three of my sisters for one Liz Clark. That offer just stands for Liz Clark's family. Liz, welcome back to Chatter, Liz.
Well, it's lovely to join you, such a smart, lovely group, and the privilege of seeing you all by Zoom is just a bonus. I miss you all.
I really miss the real contact, real people. I mean, thankfully we have Zoom because this could be a lot worse, but it's not the same. It's not the same.
No.
Yeah. And the world is not the same because we lost an amazing person. The notorious RBG. And David, I think you were with us several months ago when we had on the show, Jeffrey Rosen.
It's one of the first people I thought of, Tori.
Oh, I just traded emails with him. Jeffrey Rosen, amazing guy who wrote a wonderful book called Conversations with RBG. Mm-hmm. And it was literally just transcripts of conversations he had with her about important topics. But he put it all in context. And if in all your spare time, if you're looking for something to read about RBG right now, that conversations with Ruth Bader Ginsburg was wonderful because it really drove home, even if you don't have interest in the law, which I do because I watch a lot of Law and Order, it really drove home the enormous impact this woman had.
Yeah.
Liz, you first, what did you think when you heard the news? Not a huge surprise, but what did you think?
I'm probably a bad one to go first for fear I may dissolve because
it's okay.
Was completely devastated and shocked, and I certainly was aware of every turn of her, the precariousness of her health. Yeah. I was aware of her age, certainly the type of cancer she had. I rarely allow myself to be optimistic, but there was a part of me that just truly believed she was invincible. I mean, she was popping up here, officiating a wedding. She was doing this.
Yeah.
I've not been quite right since. I am just devastated for the loss of such a giant and a pioneer and a fearless woman, as you said, you know, who made so much possible for all women in all stations of life and minorities as well, working class people as well. I mean, she just was a champion for inclusivity and those who were often left at the margins of it. But I'll tell you what I've reflected a bit on lately is just how truly what a Renaissance woman she was.
Yes.
Her love and lifelong support of the arts, her ability and appreciation for discourse, finding common ground to share passion. Yeah. I didn't know until I saw the documentary about her life what a powerful love story was at the heart of her life. I had no idea of the tremendous relationship with this.
Yeah.
Fabulous husband who just championed her and the work ethic that it conveyed, what she did to get herself through law school and launch her career and until the end, the hours she studied and put in. I bow down with humility and it's much harder for me to think about the steps our country may take in the coming weeks and months as we think about filling her seat. I obviously can't speak about well. Yeah. So I'll stop.
No, I'll just say one quick thing, and I want to hear David's. But the contrast between her and her life. I mean, first of all, just the sheer amount of work she did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when she was studying to be in the legal profession and what she had to do in be in the legal profession, and she was raising a family and she was doing this and she was an opera fan. I mean, just the sheer volume of everything she did and always being available for weddings, mind-blowing to me, right? Absolutely mind-blowing. And she did it with class and she did it with dignity and she did it with humor and she did it with kindness and generosity. And boom, all of a sudden we are now seeing and experiencing in the next days, weeks, possibly months, whatever the opposite of all that is, what we're seeing, the smallness, the pettiness, the cheapness, the contrast couldn't be greater. But David, what did you think when you heard?
Oh, it was, well, you know, you get texts now, unfortunately.
Right, right.
You know, so it was 3 Fridays ago. I got a text at 10:30 at night, you know, a news text that said Chadwick Boseman died. I'm like, what? Yeah. That's not even possible. What are you talking about? Yeah.
He's
40.
Young. He's a baby. Yeah.
Exactly. And then this just popped up. And to Liz's point, you know, you're rooting for people to continue to do well. And you hope that they can keep beating this thing back, you know, as long as they can. And it was gutting, you know, and I thought about Jeffrey Rosen. I swear it's like the first person I thought of, because I don't know if you remember, but when we were doing that interview with him and he was talking about her, I'm sitting there looking at him and this is what went through my mind. This man's in love with this woman.
Yes.
You know, and I don't mean romantically. I mean, in the old Greek way, like adorare. Like, he adores this woman, you know, he reveres this woman, you know, and you could tell it was there. And I just felt so awful for him and people that really did know her and really came to revere her. And I can understand how people could come to revere someone as consequential as she was.
Yeah.
You know, you compare the things that her life entailed and the causes and the fights that she took on and that she championed to the venality that we have in our world today and in our government. It's so off-putting and just nauseating to compare. And so I felt so sad, but this was one where I understood that while I feel incredibly sad, I know this hit women differently than it hit me. And mm-hmm. it probably hit Jewish women differently than it hit women. Right. Yeah. So I understood that this woman's a titan, you know, like she's a titan. She's Thurgood Marshall. You know, I get it. I understand. I understand why people have the reactions that they do. I empathize with it, I should say. And so you just feel, and I've rarely gone out, and certainly not much in public, but I'm going to go pay my respects.
Always. Yeah. My daughter, Devin, and I have talked about that. We might go later tonight. We might wait till she's lying in state outside the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
But my favorite, I mean, there's so many incredible quotes. And I cannot get past you guys because you both know I'm just such a visual person. She's tiny. She was tiny. Tiny, 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 like bird size. Mm-hmm. And everything she did was so big and so consequential. Right.
Yeah.
And we all know so many big people, quote unquote, who try to put all those wonderful tributes on their shoulders and they don't deserve them. And she did. But she said, fight for the things you care about, but do it in a way that will lead others to join you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That to me just sums up her. Right.
Yeah.
I got the fight part in me. I can't do the other part. The other part. Right.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that struck me is it sounds like it was hours or very shortly before she was going to die. And I think she knew she was going to die. Mm-hmm. And she had them write down. Right. I hope that they won't replace me until there is a new president.
My fervent wish.
My fervent wish.
Yeah.
Okay. My fervent wish on my deathbed is going to be, please don't throw me in the river. Right. Like, you know, somewhere. Just put me out in the street. Someone will take the body. Right? But can you imagine having the grace and the dignity mm-hmm. and the concern to do that? Yeah. Like, incredibly selfless woman. Incredibly selfless. And I didn't know her. I'm not like everybody else in Washington. I'm not going to say, oh, I knew Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I didn't. I might have once been at a function of 5,000 people, and I saw a swarm of people around a little tiny thing. But that might have been, you know, the extent of it. But incredible. Incredible. Yeah. I'm optimistic. I think, as sad as it is, there are going to be people, probably on both sides, but there are going to be people fired up.
Yeah.
And there are going to be young people fired up, and there are going to be women who are fired up, and they're going to do what they think she would want going forward. So fingers crossed on that.
I hope so.
So segue, there's no segue here.
There's no segue.
Sublime to the ridiculous. Sublime to the ridiculous. And we'll start with the more positive stuff with David, and then Liz, we have to ask you about the incredible work you've been doing, okay? On the Washington football team.
David, you talk as long as you want.
So David,
I can't. We've been chasing you for 2 months. It's awful.
Oh, is that right? Okay, wait. Forget what I was just going to say. So anybody listening to this podcast knows Liz Clark, knows the work she's been doing on, formerly known as the Redskins, now known as the Washington football team, the incredible situation, hostile work environment, hostile harassment across the board, everything she's been doing on what used to be called the Redskins is now the Washington football team. And Liz, I know this is something, it's not as though this is new. You've known about this for quite some time, but how hard has it been for you and your colleagues to cover this story? And you covered extraordinary ground. David was just saying they've been chasing you, which is the highest compliment a good journalist can pay to another one. But how hard has it been to do this story because of the content, the nature of the story itself?
Well, let me say at the outset, you know, I'm part of a three-person team.
We don't love them as much as you.
No, my coworker Will Hobson and Beth Reinhart, who are just outstanding, tenacious journalists, and I think we each bring kind of a different quality to the reporting. You know, the subject matter of women being harassed, it's obviously distressing emotionally for me. What is so hard to bear are the stories of women for whom this was their first job out of college, or perhaps it actually was an internship that led to this first job. And so many of them, obviously separately, each conversation is personal, would say at some point, I didn't know that this wasn't how things were supposed to be in an office. I kind of thought this was the price of admission to have a career in sports if you were a woman. Yeah. And that price of admission, for those who hadn't read the stories, it's just crude, the most base crude emails, text, you know, comments on your boobs, fake or real, you know, I can't even concentrate, the dress is so hot, you're so hot, you know, that kind of stuff daily, to where these young women are like sick to their stomach each time they come to work.
Sure.
But what is so upsetting to me is just that, no, it's not the price of admission to any field in 2020 or 2015 or 20 whatever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's that. But to be honest, it's not even so much the subject matter that I think is at the heart of what has made the reporting difficult. What is at the heart of that is the deep, longstanding tradition of non-disclosure agreements.
Yes.
This team that are ubiquitous, and it's not uncommon in pro sports, or you know, there are legitimate reasons for it. It protects your intellectual property and you don't take trade secrets elsewhere, but it's something that you can expand in an elastic way to just muzzle any employee from talking about the workplace experience. And, you know, again, many young women had no choice but to sign them, you know, sign this or else you won't get your 2-week severance. So it's that is a barrier. And then for the precious few who don't have that, there is the absolute fear of, you know, somebody's going to come after me. The team is going to come after me, and they might be in their 30s. They still need another job. You don't want to have on your resume, you know, something you have to omit from your resume because
right.
blow back at you. So they're very vulnerable people.
So what do you think happens next? So the last time I've paid attention to this, Beth Wilkinson, very, very smart, intense
yeah.
lawyer, is in charge of the investigation of
yeah.
what's been going on. She reports to the NFL now.
Correct.
For that investigation. What happens next?
Well, you know, her work is going to continue, as you said. And so she is listening to, interviewing, you know, employees about their experience. I have a sense of what she's probably hearing, but I'm sure she's talking to women that we didn't speak to and, you know, ideally men, because there are men with stories as well.
Yeah.
The NDAs have been lifted for that purpose of talking to her. I think that still, there's still going to be some people who are scared, you know,
sure, absolutely.
And we had a little, well, not a little story, but a follow-up story about the use of private investigators
mm-hmm.
Right. asking some questions of former employees that has scared a lot of people. So that practice supposedly has stopped as it relates to workplace issues. So I'm saying a lot of words and not getting to the heart of your question. I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's a category of punitive measures the league could take, which is fines and other things. I think a lot of people are leaping immediately to a question, oh, is the team going to change hands? And it's not remotely there. And I cannot speculate on that. That's for the league to say. And I don't have any evidence of that. So I don't know.
Well, it's really important work. That's what I know. Really important work. It's a tremendous service. And not just because it's a team that has such a storied place in everybody's lives here in the DMV, but it's really important work. And I remember talking to Megan Toohey and some of the women who worked on #MeToo in the New York Times.
Sure.
They were most gratified, not just by the work they had done, but what it inspired others to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm willing to bet, David, that this work done by Liz and her colleagues, I realize she has colleagues on this, but Liz and her colleagues has inspired others to pursue similar paths.
No
I'm
question.
Just guessing, right?
I don't think there's any question about it. And I don't know that the league is going to do anything either, short of a smoking gun, direct
yeah.
evidence. But I would say this, every league has a breaking point. And at some point, and who knows what it is, it doesn't have to be the thing that you think it is. Right.
It could be some other event that happens.
Right. At some point, Major League Baseball said, you know what? We're better off without Mark Schott. You know,
yeah.
at some point, the NBA,
yeah.
said, the NBA said, you know what? We're better off without Donald Sterling. It's not worth it for us to keep Donald Sterling.
Yeah.
And so knowing that there are, I'm sure, other people with other stories to tell, and to Liz's point, some of them are probably being told to Beth Wilkinson and maybe to other people. You never know what the tipping point's going to be.
Right.
So while I think there's a very minute chance, I wouldn't say there's no chance.
Right. I agree. And I'm more in the something like that probably will happen. Okay. We're still in the football genre. So it's a
yes.
terrific segue to Jim Rooney, who in our Zoom world we can see up in the corner. Jim Rooney, thank you so much for joining us. It is great to have you with us.
Can you guys hear me?
We can
yes.
absolutely
yes.
hear you.
Yes.
Check that every time I'm on Zoom.
Every time. So the great thing about having your own show is you get to be a homer. And as a Pittsburgh native, it is so much fun to have you on. It was so much fun reading your book about your dad, A Different Way to Win. It's a really terrific, interesting look at your dad, Dan Rooney. And it's wonderful. And of course, it's positive. He was an amazing person. But you took it very seriously, and you really looked at some of the issues and you questioned some of the context in which he made his decisions, which must have been hard as doing that as a son. But thank you for joining us. We'd like to start with a little bit on the personal side. Were you really one of nine children?
Yes, I am. I'm the eighth of nine children.
Oh my God. Wow. So there were no pictures of you. I'm the youngest of five. No pictures, no stories, those kinds of things.
You understand well. My wife is the baby of 11.
Oh.
So we have three children, and everyone said, why didn't you have more? We're like, after three, you don't get any attention paid to you.
None whatsoever. When you were a kid growing up in the Rooney family, which was so much about football and the Steelers, were you allowed to like other sports, or was it all football all the time?
Well, it's funny because in Super Bowl IX, our first Super Bowl, I was pretty young, and I had always liked the Minnesota Vikings because they wore the collar purple, and I had this Vikings tassel cap. Uh-huh. And we're going into the Super Bowl against them. And I remember my grandfather saying to my mother, he can't be wearing that hat anymore. You know, that's what we're going to get.
But that was the closest you came to straying off the family track.
Exactly. Exactly.
Nice. Nice.
I don't think I would become a Ravens fan nowadays, even though they wear purple. So.
Not. Well, my claim to fame in the Steelers world is that David knows the story. One of my sisters and I were in Three Rivers for the Immaculate Reception. Mm. And like everyone else, we would swear to our graves that we saw it.
Yeah.
No one saw it. It was horrible weather, classic Pittsburgh weather, rainy, sleeting, freezing cold. We were massively overserved because we were surrounded by a bunch of steelworkers who were keeping us warm with Boilermakers. But that's and I almost put on my Steelers jersey tonight, but it is so gross and so disgusting I couldn't put it on. But Jim, I promised Liz and David, I'm going to get out of the way on this one because they both had the chance to work with and cover and interview Dan Rooney many times. Liz, he had an important part in your career path.
Oh, yes. Boy, I'll try to be brief, Jim, but, you know, my regard for your dad, I can't even find the words. So when I was a much younger sports writer in the early 90s, I worked at the Charlotte Observer, and my job was to figure out whether Charlotte would get one of the NFL expansion teams. And of course, your father wore so many hats, I'm sure that could fill another volume of books. But among them was he served on the expansion committee. And so my job for 3 years was to sort of build relationships and try to figure out what were the issues of the different cities. And your father, he was so gracious and so kind. And of course, he was a loyal person to the league. He never, you know, gave me secrets he shouldn't have. But he always took my call, treated me with respect. He helped me understand the background as he could. Every time, so it was a long, long process, that expansion process, but I had occasion to see him many years later when I was a beat writer for the Washington team, and we'd go to La Trobe for a scrimmage periodically, and I'd see your dad in his sneakers walking the sidelines, and it was just like it was yesterday. He was so gracious, and he wrote me at least two handwritten notes after the expansion thing ended and later in my career, just paying me a compliment and reminding me that he was there if I needed anything. And they are among my treasured possessions. So it's such an honor to listen to you and meet you by Zoom.
David, recollection? Yeah.
I got no notes, but that's okay. All right. It's okay. But no, Jim, I talked to your dad a lot when I covered the NFL many years ago. That's when I was covering it, it's right after Jerry Jones had bought the Cowboys, like right after. I was there the night of the Jerry Jones press conference in Dallas after they fired Tom Landry. And so your father he was my Jerry Jones whisperer. And I would go, but wait a minute, this isn't what the league does, right? And he would go, no, that's not what the league does. And he would explain why Jerry was doing these things that nobody else wanted him to do. But he was also such a resource with regard to the rule that now bears his name. Mm. When I would call after I had talked to, so many African-American coaches who were frustrated and didn't know they'd ever get a shot. And you talk to John Wooten and he'd just be beside himself and apoplectic. And your dad was always the one NFL owner who understood that, hey, we got to change this. This isn't right. We got to do something better than what we've got here. And so he was held, as you know, in such high regard by so many people, but especially so many black coaches who got a chance because of that rule, who got an interview because of that rule, even if they didn't get the job. And it helped them become better interviewers down the road. So, you know, again, just as Liz said, your dad was all aces in my book. And, you know, and I've always loved the Steelers franchise. I always felt like they do it the right way.
I would have nothing to do with David if he was not a Steelers fan. But Jim, where did this come from? I mean, lots of people are familiar with the Rooney Rule. And by the way, as somebody who spent a lot of time in business, the Rooney Rule is now applied to some aspects of government, to many, many businesses. I personally had a Rooney Rule the last two or three places I worked. But let's talk about your dad and this book, A Different Way to Win, because he grew up in Pittsburgh in the 30s and 40s. And not a lot of, you know, racial equality going on in Pittsburgh in the 30s and 40s. And he's this Irish guy. Where did this come from? He was enlightened before his time. Where do you think it came from?
Well, you know, my grandfather started the team in 32. And my grandfather, you know, we had an African-American, Ray Kemp, on the team in 1932. And then when the Washington team came in, you know, the George Preston Marshall basically said, you know, you can't bring black players to D.C. And so my grandfather and I talk about in the book, you know, it is the one sort of glaring failure of his career that he followed along with that, because what is troubling, and it also helps you to some degree. And again, I hope I say this the right way, but how insignificant the NFL and the Steelers were to his life. My grandfather was considered one of the best boxing promoters of his time. And, you know, we hear a lot about, Joe Louis. Mm-hmm. But what was happening at that time, and, you know, you folks may know these stories better than me, but on the fight cards, they would have black fighters fight, but they were getting killed. I mean, it was just merciless how they're being treated. And then, not that this was as important, the second piece, but then they wouldn't win. And my grandfather's fighting promotion group was considered to be one of the most fair, both with judges and with referees, that the referee stopped the fight, that they, you know, they were known to treat people humanely, and judges would, which was really important because if you won, you got more money, that they would declare black fighters as winners. He also played a role with the Negro League teams in Pittsburgh, which were two of the best teams in the Negro League, the Homestead Grays and the Pittsburgh Crawfords. The Grays in particular, Composey, who is the only man in the Basketball and Baseball Hall of Fames, he said every year that, you know, the Grays would have a good season, but then, you know, it was a tiny operation. I mean, they were basically a barnstorming group, that he would go to Art Rooney for funds for spring training, and that Art Rooney would support spring training. So my father grew up with this from his father, and it was an important notion. I one quick story. I don't want to take all the time up on the.
No, really, this is your time. Really, this is your time. And we love stories. Go ahead.
But my father says one of the things that really opened his eyes to inequality and race and the differences. So they lived in a part of Pittsburgh called the North Side, which even then was one of the sort of few integrated neighborhoods. And during the Joe Louis, Billy Kahn fight. Billy Kahn was called the Pittsburgh Kid, great, great Pittsburgh boxer, that, you know, everyone was rooting for Pittsburgh, but they had two black kids from the neighborhood listening on the radio with them. And when he said, you know, he always remembered this moment, that when Joe Louis won and he barely beat the Pittsburgh Kid,
Billy Kahn,
they were happy. And he said it really hit him that, oh, there is a difference, you know, and that was the first time in his life that he saw such a visceral experience that was different for him. And he always talked about that opening his eyes in such a significant way. So that's way, way back. But those are some of the origins.
Some of the roots of it. Yeah. So for the former Attorney General Eric Holder compared your dad, compared Dan Rooney to Branch Rickey, who helped break the color barrier in baseball. And Joe Green wrote this wonderful, people should always read forwards to books. Mm-hmm. They should always read forwards and acknowledgments because there's always interesting things there. Joe Green, the legendary Joe Green, wrote the foreword. And it was this remarkable, very positive, very optimistic, right? Tribute to your dad, of course, and saying this is really changing things and helping things, the Rooney Rule, et cetera, going forward. If your dad were alive today, what would he say about where we are? What would he say about where we are with Black Lives Matter? What would he say about Colin Kaepernick? Colin Kaepernick, I think it was almost 4 years ago exactly, took a knee, and his career was changed because of it. What would your dad think?
Well, I think there's no question. My grandfather, I think, did some important things, but my father was an activist.
Yeah.
My father was not afraid. We talk about the league meetings, and look, you have to get 24 of 32 votes if you're getting anything done. So I'm not going to say he was someone that was just picking fights every time. He always tried to build compromise. He was trying to get some things done, but he was an activist. He was not afraid to say this is wrong. The two places he did it most had to do with racial inequality. I mean, we know it with coaches, but if you look at the Steelers, Bill Nunn, who's going into the Hall of Fame,
right?
My father brought Bill in, and from 68 to 1980, the Steelers drafted more players from the HBCUs. We actually doubled the league's average of any other team. He understood that this was something different. And then the piece of that we wrote about in the book, But I think it's so, so important in this moment. Now I can get back to the moment, but you had Bill, you had Tony Dungy grew up with us, becomes our defensive coordinator. You had Joe Gilliam being the first African-American named starter prior to a season beginning. You had 1978, the second of the set of Super Bowls. Our three captains were Joe Green, Sam Davis, and Don Eschell. It was the first time in NFL history. So the point that I'm trying to make here in a long-winded way is that when you create a culture that is welcoming, that is diverse, and you do it the right way, leadership will naturally come, and that folks are in leadership positions. And I think that influence, now you could say it took too many years after, and I think he would probably agree, but it was not just that we had this commitment to diversity and we had a lot of folks who had different experiences. It was that he saw leadership come about and folks were, we were more successful than everyone else. And he didn't love us. He didn't love me sort of, I say that much more than he would have ever said it. We had a competitive advantage because we went to a talent pool that no one else was going to. And we allowed people to have leadership roles that few others were allowing to have leadership roles. And then I think those were the things that influenced him into the Rooney Rule.
Yeah. Bill, there's a wonderful line in the book, which is called A Different Way to Win, by Bill Nunn. He says, I don't think Dan sees color, which is an amazing thing for him. And I'm sure you've heard this 1,000 times, but it has been studied again and again, and not enough businesses respond to it. But the more diverse your board, the more diverse your senior leadership, the more diverse your entire workforce, the more successful you are. If all you care about is money, and P&L, you are more successful. It's been proven again and again on paper. And obviously your father and grandfather were trying to put together a winning team, but it's something they saw a long time ago, which I still find extraordinary. Can we shift to Ireland a little bit? I could spend the entire time on Pittsburgh, but shift to Ireland. So President Barack Obama taps him to be ambassador to Ireland, which is, if you want an ambassadorship, that's one of the top ones. Ireland, Paris, London, right? But Ireland's right up there. And you get to live in a wonderful place called Phoenix Park. Did you ever go there, Jim?
Spent many, many, much time there, a lot.
Beautiful, beautiful place. But the world of diplomacy is very different than the world your dad spent so many years in. And your dad, a very inclusive, but also a very strong figure. And usually when he said, we're going to do something, those somethings got done. Right. How did he first find the world of diplomacy?
Well, he was somewhat of a natural because they were trying to shift some of the approach towards diplomacy. And I quote Jake Sullivan. Jake was a policy leader for Obama, for Hillary, and now for Joe Biden. And so Jake said, look, we were trying to do this thing called public diplomacy, where we were trying to get out of the boardrooms and trying to get out of it, just being heads of state talking to each other. And he said, you know, we have this 78-year-old ambassador, and he ends up being the best of all of them at public diplomacy. My father set up these conversations with every county in Ireland, and he visited every county, and he would have an economic development town hall. He would have a different issue town hall. And there, and it became, you know, at 78, you know, President Obama's whole thing, but, you know, youth was such a big part of it. They're pointing out that their oldest ambassador is sort of the model. So that was something we're proud of. The other thing that he did that, you know, I mentioned in the book, but was so cool to hear these stories was Dublin has gone from, you know, when I was in Dublin in the 70s, I don't know, if you had 2% of a Muslim population, I would have been surprised.
Right.
So it's about 17%. And he started these interfaith luncheons with the Jewish community, the Muslim community, the Catholic community, the Protestant community in Dublin. And the folks that told me about that said, you know, the Muslim community just felt so welcome that it was happening, you know, by this ambassador of President Obama, that they lived in this country where they knew there had been all this strife, but they still felt like they didn't belong.
Sure.
And then it was this sort of, again, old man who, you know, you would think at first glance, I mean, you know, my dad, you saw him, Liz, especially you talked about it, you know, he was 5'7", you know, frail as can be those last 5 years, but he's the guy bringing this conversation together in such a meaningful way. So, you know, again, that was, I had known that it happened. I'd known these lunches sort of existed. But when I had people sort of share exactly what it was like and sort of the insight that he had, and I had shared the book with President Obama, and he said, I didn't even know this went on to this extent. So that was kind of cool.
But Liz, you'll love this. Jim, you can tell more about it. He sent postcards to President Obama to update him. In the old days, ambassadors would send cables. Right.
Yes.
And then, of course, in the last whatever, phone calls, emails, et cetera. And Jim, I don't want to take it. It's in your book. But you talk about he sent postcards because he thought it was just an easier way to reach him. Don't waste his time calling him.
Beautiful.
Emails have all sorts of problems. So he sent him postcards from Ireland, right, with cute little pictures of Ireland on the back.
And what a wonderful tribute to our U.S. Postal Service.
Yes.
Exactly.
And he never put a foot wrong.
He
didn't send any postcards to his boss, Hillary.
Exactly.
I mean, any emails.
Right.
All right. Talk about the American Ireland Fund, which he also set up. I mean, this goes to the long view. One of the things when you read about his career, when you read about what he did with the Steelers and the Rooney Rule and the NFL, and one of the things that was fascinating about what you wrote about him in the NFL, because of his success and because of everything he did for the NFL, it contributed to the NFL becoming this huge, huge financial deal. Right, tons of money. He wasn't always comfortable with that, right? He wasn't always comfortable with how much money became associated with football.
Yeah, no. And he understood and probably was, I mean, he was one of the first guys sort of out of the gate and understanding that free agency was going to happen. So how do we make free agency work in a way that the players get some of what they want? And so that's why we have a salary cap, which I know people complain about in the franchise tag. But he said, look, if we're going to have free agency, we have to have competitive balance. And that took about 35 years to get so many folks on board. But the idea, this idea of money in the long run, Victoria, I think is sort of the differentiator about him. And look, he might even say he failed on a certain level. I mean, you know, there is, you know, just a massive amount of, you know, over-interest maybe in money in the National Football League, and decisions are made that he often didn't agree with. But the funny thing was, is that you look at it over and over again and how right he was. And again, I'm his son, I get it, but I want to sound like I have some credibility, but even into the Rooney Rule, one of the biggest problems with the lack of diversity is this crazy drive we have to hire our coach immediately. And not
interesting.
Really get to understand them.
Sure.
And if you look both in the head coaches and in the assistant coaches, you know, most of those folks are hired within 2.5 weeks. That's the most important job in your franchise. And, you know, in other businesses, they might take 6 months. Now, I don't know that we'll ever get to a 6-month standpoint, but even if you build out a 4 to 6 weeks time frame, you know, you could, A, all of the social science says you will become more comfortable with people, that, you know, you can break down your barriers because you're going to take time, you're going to get to know them, you're going to have that experience. And that's exactly what he did in the Mike Tomlin interview. And B, you're probably going to make higher quality decisions, but everyone feels there's this competitive need to get this coach now. And my father, if you look at Bill Cowher and you look at Mike Tomlin, they were the last hires in the cycle. They took almost twice as long as the rest of the team, yet they've been, you know, count Chuck in there.
You're validated.
Even in the process of hiring coaches, which is ultimately the Rooney Rule, the way he did it, which is the model, was about the long game. It was about taking time. And you know, my father, my brother Art, who's the president, Kevin Colbert, our GM, and dad was involved in the X's and O conversation with Mike Tomlin. But at the end of the day, my father spent most of the time, Mike talks about this, you know, asking him about high school coaches, about his mother, about what relationships meant to him. And could my father sort of check in on those nuances to see, does this guy see people as a stepping stone to further his career, or does he really value people? And this, to me, this is sort of the key point of understanding or getting beyond diversity or getting beyond difference. You know, he saw Mike and Kia as the same as the Rooneys. They certainly don't look the same as us, but they share the same values and they fit in the culture so well. And so that's where I try to go to the story, but it is that model over and over. I try to say, Victoria, that if you take a little more time with things, you can have an experience with people that are different, that is more effective and more successful. And you know, we've created these competitive advantages in doing that.
It worked. It works great. As a Steeler fan, I'm very, very appreciative, of course. All right, let's get you out with this. So you wrote a lot about your dad. It really is a wonderful, wonderful book. What in the course of your work and your research, you had to dig into things, what was going on in Ireland at the time. What did you learn about him that you didn't know? You spent a lot of time with him growing up and in your work, you're around him all the time. What did you learn about him in the course of writing this book that you didn't know?
Well, I think the thing that was the biggest sort of surprise, it wasn't something that I discovered. It was Commissioner Tagliabue, who I spent probably the most individual time with interviewing, said, you know, your father was the biggest risk taker I've ever seen. And when you look at Dan Rooney, you don't see, you know, 5'3" white guy, frail as can be, the biggest risk taker. But he said, look, the Rooney Rule, his negotiations in labor, even his approach toward the Steelers, he didn't know those things were going to be successful. And maybe at the end you would feel that he would get some sense of that. But he would step into things that he felt, you know, were the right thing to do and that were different than what everyone else was doing. And, you know, he still had that confidence to sort of try something new. And he said, you know, that is what risk-taking is. It's not all about money. It's not about the return you get. It's about doing something that you don't know what the outcome is going to be. And he said, you know, your father always tried to do it based on the right thing, you know, and I know that's a subjective term, but you know, having some sense of bettering things than what they were prior to the decision being made. So Dan Rooney being a risk taker is not really what I would have thought of as, you know, who he was.
I totally would have. Okay. Did your siblings like the book? Your family like the book?
Well, it's funny. I saw John Mara from the Giants at the Super Bowl. And he says, you know, like us, he has a million brothers and sisters. He says, well, what did everyone say? I says, well, everyone said they liked it. And then they would give me 10 things they would have said different.
And they can write their own book, starting. Right. Okay. This one is called A Different Way to Win. Liz, you have a question?
Well, it doesn't mess up the program.
Not
May
at all.
I ask one question? I've really... Oh, is he? Oh, there he is.
Yes.
Jim, thank you.
I'm used to Zoom doing this so that I'm not, you know...
Well, I wondered this almost since the time, you know, after I got to know your dad a little bit and to know the other owners, which at the time there might have been 27 other owners. It grew, of course, over time. So it's a question about money and the league and your family. And simply, I hope I can articulate this. As I think about your father and the ethos of the Steelers, I always felt that I mean, clearly all owners, it's a for-profit business. They are attuned to the bottom line. They are there to make money. But of all the teams, I always felt that the Rooneys, your dad, viewed the Steelers in part as a public trust, in a sense, belonging to the city, to the people of Pittsburgh. And I'm wondering, am I just rose-colored about that and projecting that on your dad? Or in your family life, was it ever discussed in words? You know, what does it mean to own an NFL team? What does it mean to own this team? Do we own it? Or are we stewards of it, or something in between?
Look, at the end of the day, you'd have to say it's something in between because mm-hmm. it was a business. And my father wasn't against a business making money.
Sure.
But he absolutely didn't think that all the money in the world was the most important thing. Two quick stories and then I'll get out of here. Although I love talking to you guys. I'm happy to stay, but I don't want to eat your whole show up. So, being around my father and observing his life, he got to see a lot of people who were very effective and successful. Barack Obama, Paul Tagliabue, I can name, 20 other names like that who he really enjoyed those folks. And then he was around a lot of people who were really, really rich. And when he was around the folks that were effective and weren't about money, and frankly, I think his relationship with Barack Obama, the biggest strength, I think they kind of gravitated because of this diversity issue, but the biggest strength was both of them had that fundamental belief that things don't make you happy. And they would have many conversations about that. And so those folks he enjoyed, he was highly engaged. People who were just rich and kind of enjoyed the fact that they were rich, that really bothered him. And I don't want to say bothered him. He dismissed it. He didn't think it was important. And then we would ask him, we're kids. You'd hear these things in the newspaper. Forbes says you're worth this much or that much. You have the charter of the team behind him. He'd say, we're worth whatever the price of paper is on that thing. We're not for sale. So now we've gone through, we have new owner, new partners, everything else. My brother has to manage a business, but my father was, I hope I'm a decent person, but I don't consider myself in that world. My father really was one of a kind.
Really was. Yeah. And thank you for writing the book, Jim. And I really encourage people to buy this book, hopefully at a local independent bookstore.
Penguin Books in Pittsburgh. That's
where Penguin Books in Pittsburgh, almost 100 years old.
Wow.
It really is. For those of us, it's very easy to get cynical about the NFL these days. It's easy to get cynical about a lot of things, but he really transcended a really important arc in this country's history. And he did some really, really important work. And I found it inspiring. I found it really inspiring, thinking, wow, if this little short guy in sneakers could get done what he got done, pretty amazing. There's some, maybe it's something about size. We were talking about RBG earlier. Maybe you have to be little to do really big things. In which case I'm sunk. I'm absolutely sunk. Jim Rooney, thank you so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate it. Loved having you with us. Good luck with everything. Write another book or tell your siblings to write a book. And Liz and David, stay with me for a second. Two pieces of housekeeping, and then we have a deserted island segment. We are back next week with Barbara Kingsolver, who is a really amazing novelist, essayist, poet, with a very intriguing backstory, Congo and Kentucky. That's all I'll say. Her backstory is as interesting, and her latest book is called How to Fly in 10,000 Easy Lessons. It's poetry, and David, don't make a face. Yeah, I know how you and I feel about poetry. It's really wonderful and very accessible. I really, really liked it. So we have
a... You don't hate all poetry.
Name one poem.
You know what? What's the one? I'm the master of my fate. I am the king of my soul. Invictus. I like Invictus.
Okay. All right.
That's a nice poem.
You have any favorite poems, Liz?
None that come to mind. I like Rilke as a poet in general, but I'm lacking on a favorite poem.
Yeah, well, there's a reason for that. But Barbara's is really, really good. So we have her next week. Okay, so coming up soon, in a few weeks, Barack Obama is coming out with his book, his memoir, which has taken him a very long time to write. And mercifully, it's going to come out a few days after Election Day. So as we're waiting for the results of the election, we can read Barack Obama's book. Yeah. Michelle Obama's book, Becoming, which I keep saying is not just the best political memoir I've read, it's one of the best books I've read. Because it has very little to do with the fact that he's this amazing politician and became president, and their life because of that. It is more about a couple in the 21st century, in the 20th century, in 21st century, and how they deal with their aspirations and raising a family. It's just a remarkable book. And her book sold something like 1.5 million copies in the first week it came out. Mm-hmm. And within 2 weeks was the most successful political memoir ever. And then since 2018 has sold about 10 million copies. So the question for the table is, which book sells more? I am deeply hopeful that Michelle Obama's book sells more than her husband's. Mm. What do you think? The market is saturated, inundated with lots of political books these days. They all tend to be about someone whose name we shall not mention on the show.
Yes.
But it is saturated. It's going to be a crazy time. A year ago, the publisher thought it was smart to have it come out a few days after the election. Now it's looking like not such great timing. It's going to be expensive. But what do you think? Who's going to sell more? David?
I think the fact that there will be such, no matter what the results of the election are, 3 days after that or 5 days after that or a week after that, there will be such a longing for a return to normalcy. And so I think there will be an enormous amount of interest in his book. So my guess, I know nothing about the book industry. My guess is the president's book will sell more than Michelle Obama's book.
Okay. Liz, what do you think?
I think he will not top his wife's sales. Mm-hmm. And I don't. And I have absolute regard for President Obama, his elegance of thought. And I know it will be an outstanding book. But the reason I say she will retain that title. Real simply, I think women are better readers than men. I think there was, in my experience, just enormous, enormous fervent word of mouth about her book. I mean, almost every woman I know who read it was evangelical about her book. You must read this.
Yes.
You know, from my 94-year-old aunt to women my age and a younger generation. And so I just think that Catching Wildfire, and it isn't easily categorized. It's not a political book. It's quite transcendent and speaks to every phase of life.
Yeah, I agree. I think people who are interested in politics will read Barack Obama's book. But no, I'm with you. Her book, I had people who probably have never voted their entire life sending me emails going, oh, and there was this line in the 14th chapter. Did you hear her say this? But people loved it because she read it. It has so little to do with politics. It has so much to do with just being people. And so I think hers will sell more. David, you're going to lose.
Won't be the first time.
Yeah. David, we wish you the best with everything going on right now. Liz, thank you for joining. Give Joan the fish, Jack the Beagle, a hug for us.
Well, Jack has been begging the whole time. I hope I haven't been distracting. But
no,
not at all. My whole nuclear family here. Thank you.
Everybody, thanks for listening. Wash your hands, stay healthy, and we'll see you next week.